This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Hi, my name's Mike. I'm one of the producers here in the briefing room. And one of the strangest developments in what has been, to put it lightly, a very unusual presidential campaign in the United States this year has been Donald Trump's position on Russia. Now, traditionally, the Republican Party has been the more hawkish in terms of foreign policy, but that's completely been flipped by Trump this year. He's praised Vladimir Putin, and Putin has, to some degree, repaid the compliment. There's been a lot of claims and counterclaims around, and in this edition of the Briefing Room, we're going to put aside the politics, or at least try to, and look at the facts. What exactly are Donald Trump's ties to Russia and to Vladimir Putin? How deep do they go, and how might it influence the result in November? David Aronovich is presenting the program, but first, here's Trump on Putin.
If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader. He's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader.
Donald Trump on Vladimir Putin. Now, Hillary Clinton on Donald Trump.
He very early on allied himself with Putin's policies. I mean, to pull out of NATO, for goodness sakes, right? And he furthermore has praised Putin. He seems to have this bizarre attraction to dictators.
Tonight in the Briefing Room, the links between Trump and Russia. Is it true, as has been asserted, that Russia is directly engaging in an attempt to influence the American presidential election, or is this contention an overblown fantasy? Is Donald Trump Russia's man, or just anxious to rebuild half-burned bridges? We'll be talking to two writers who've been looking into Putin and this year's American election. But first, Gabriel Gatehouse, the BBC's international investigations correspondent and formerly a correspondent in Ukraine and Russia, has been looking at the specific links between the Russians and the Trump campaign.
It's mid-July. There's a week to go before the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Donald Trump is the party's presumptive, though not yet official, nominee for President of the United States. Behind the scenes, delegates from across the country have come together to hammer out the Republican platform, that's party policy, for the next 4 years. On the National Security Subcommittee, about 20 delegates are discussing Russia and the conflict in Ukraine. Rachel Hoff is one of them, and one of her colleagues has a proposal.
This delegate put forward an amendment that called for continuing and increasing, if necessary, sanctions against Russia, continuing to work with NATO in planning for the future in that part of the world, and perhaps most importantly, from my perspective, providing lethal defensive weapons to the Ukrainian military.
There's no surprise here. Most senior Republican foreign policy makers in Washington support providing lethal weapons to Ukraine, even though the current administration does not. But then, says Rachel Hoff, something unusual happened. Two members of Donald Trump's campaign staff, who'd previously shown little interest in proceedings, suddenly got involved.
They pulled aside the author of the amendment to discuss its content. From what she reports afterward, the campaign staff asked her to strike the words providing lethal defensive weapons from the amendment and replace it with a more watered down language of providing appropriate assistance to Ukraine.
This incident might have remained an obscure footnote in a presidential campaign, but for the combustible combination of two elements, Trump and Russia. Apart from Donald Trump's frequent and lavish praise of President Putin, his campaign has also hired a surprising number of staff with a history of working in Russia or for political and business figures sympathetic to the Kremlin. Most prominent among them is Paul Manafort, who was Trump's campaign chairman until last month, and whose CV includes a 10-year stint advising Viktor Yanukovych, the former pro-Moscow president of Ukraine. At the convention, Trump's detractors detected the hand of Manafort behind the softening of the language on lethal aid to Ukraine. Was Manafort doing the Kremlin's bidding? Nonsense, say Trump supporters.
When this happened, it was not by design, not out of some conspiracy theory. It was simply to stop an aggressive and over-the-top amendment.
That's Michael Caputo, another former staffer on the Trump campaign.
If Paul Manafort did make this change, it's not just because he understood Ukraine and Russia. It would be because he understands that you'd never put the words lethal aid in an American political platform. Imagine the hue and cry if we did.
Donald Trump has never knowingly shied away from controversy. But on this issue, he suddenly looks cautious. Paul Manafort resigned last month amid increased scrutiny of his activities in Ukraine. But he's not the only Trump staffer with connections to the Kremlin. Having worked in Russia in the late 1990s, Michael Caputo returned to the United States. But he continued to work for Russian clients, including the state-run monopoly Gazprom.
Early on after I came back, I represented Gazprom Media, which at the time had taken over one of the last considered independent television stations, which was controlled by an oligarch that was trying very hard to overthrow the Kremlin. When I look back after representing Gazprom and what appears now to be Putin's position on the media, I wish I had not done it because I believe that the design to control all media existed even then when I was looking at it in a rather naive fashion. It wasn't too long after that we became more obvious that Vladimir Putin was not the kind of leader that I would want to work for.
But Donald Trump's enthusiasm for Putin remains apparently undimmed. Last week, he gave an interview to RT, the English-language TV station controlled by the Kremlin. As a businessman, Trump has long been interested in Russia. His repeated attempts to launch real estate projects there go back to Soviet days. None of them has come to anything. And in July, Mr. Trump himself tweeted,
"For the record, I have zero investments in Russia."
But that doesn't mean he hasn't done business with Russia. In 2013, he took his Miss Universe beauty pageant to Moscow, for which he received a portion of a $14 million fee. Trump invited Putin to attend, again on Twitter.
"Do you think Putin will be going to the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow in November? If so, will he become my new best friend?"
The Russian president never came, but he did send a traditional lacquered box as a gift. Then there's the question of funding from Russian investors in Donald Trump. After a number of bankruptcies, many US and European banks are reluctant to lend to Trump's businesses. Franklin Foyer is a journalist who's investigated Mr. Trump's finances.
As banks have shied away from Trump, he's had to go fishing for capital in less conventional places. Russians have helped fund many of his biggest construction projects in the United States and in other countries. And Russians have bought many of the units in his residential buildings. According to his son, Russians form an extremely important part of his business empire.
Michael Caputo, the former campaign staffer, began working for Trump 3 years ago when the businessman was thinking of running for governor of New York State.
Mr. Trump's interest in Russia when I was talking to him in 2013, 2014 about running for governor was quite limited to what he was doing with the Miss Universe pageant. In fact, after finding out that I lived in Russia for the better part of a decade and worked for the Kremlin, he didn't seem the least bit interested. We've talked about Russia only in the context of beautiful women vying for a global title. We did have a discussion briefly where he said, how did you get along in Russia? And I said it was real difficult because we have this thing called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in the United States, that if you do something corrupt in another country, you are guilty of the same crime in the United States. My assumption was, after our conversation, and it was brief, was that Mr. Trump had looked at doing business and even developing properties in Russia, but walked away from it because it was just too dirty.
Why do you think Donald Trump seems so enamored of Vladimir Putin?
You know, that's a good question. I believe Donald Trump is absolutely sincere when he says that that he respects the strength of his leadership. As a leader of Russians, he's a very strong man. And I believe that Donald Trump respects strong leaders. I don't believe that Donald Trump actually feels that Vladimir Putin is necessarily an enemy of this nation. I think whenever Donald Trump speaks about Vladimir Putin, it drives the liberals in America wild. And I really believe Donald Trump gets a huge kick out of driving his opponents crazy.
Michael Caputo, interviewed by Gabriel Gatehouse, who's also in the briefing room with me now, along with my guests, Anne Applebaum of the Legatum Institute. She's also a columnist with the Washington Post. And joining us on the line from New York is Franklin Foyer, who you heard earlier, who's a fellow at the think tank New America and a contributing editor to Slate.com. So let's start at the beginning. Trump is a businessman and he's long wanted to do business in Russia, but as of yet, there's no Trump Moscow Tower. Gabriel, what does it take to do business in Russia?
Well, it takes contacts. And certainly in the 1990s, it took corruption that continues to a certain extent today. And so, in a way, you might argue that Trump's failure, despite repeated attempts to do business in Russia, speaks in his favour. Trump never actually realised any real estate deals in Russia, but he did do other business. He exported his own now-defunct Trump vodka there, not terribly successfully. He held that Miss Universe pageant, but above all, he made contacts.
It's an enjoyable thought, him exporting vodka to Russia.
Coles, Newcastle, etc.
Indeed. Franklin Foyer, that doesn't mean, does it, really, because he's failed that he hasn't tried. I mean, what do you make of Trump's business connections to Russia over the years?
First, I think Michael Caputo understates the extent to which Trump went to Russia and solicited Russian business. He attempted to build not just buildings, but the biggest buildings in Moscow on about five different occasions. But his failure in those instances doesn't really actually amount to an absolute failure. He built up this brand in Russia and he solicited Russian business elites. Those very elites came to save his bacon when Trump later went into bankruptcy and he was desperate for capital to buck up his biggest building projects in North America and Europe.
So let's be quite clear about that. When Trump was in financial difficulty, the contacts he'd made in his various attempts at ventures in Russia with oligarchs actually got him out of some trouble.
Right. To be perfectly clear, the financing of Trump projects is very, very difficult to discern. What we do know is this, is that Trump has had a wild up and down career. As he recovered from bankruptcy about 15 years ago, the big banks in the United States and Europe wouldn't touch Trump. And that meant that Trump had to partner with some dodgier characters in order to finance his project. It's very, very hard to put a precise dollar figure on the amount of money that Trump actually got from Russia. But what we do know is that his biggest projects, the Trump Soho, the Trump Towers Toronto, all were funded with Russian money.
Gabriel, let us briefly an observation, which is those kind of contacts with oligarchs are not totally unreminiscent, frankly, of other contacts that other people in the West have with Russian oligarchs, are they?
Certainly not. You think of Oleg Deripaska, for example, who at one point was trying to do some business with Paul Manafort, Donald Trump's former campaign chairman. Now, of course, Oleg Deripaska is great mates with George Osborne and Peter Mandelson. We shouldn't pretend that Donald Trump is unique here.
Anne Applebaum, you've written that Trump is an oligarch in the Russian style. So what did you mean by that?
That was a comment not really about Russian influence on Trump, which is a slightly separate issue. That was more a comment about Trump's own aspirations. And I think actually it's quite significant that he admires Putin. I mean, what does Putin represent? Putin represents somebody who has first used money to get into politics and then used politics to make money. He represents really a class of people, I should say, who've done that. And this looks to be the same way that Trump is behaving. at least one of the reasons for his electoral campaign is to funnel money to Trump properties and Trump businesses. They're lending out their office space, for example, to the campaign. I should add that aesthetically, there's an enormous amount of similarity between Trump's personal aesthetic and the Russian oligarch aesthetic. You know, gold taps, lots of girls in skimpy clothes around him, lots of very lavish, you know, tasteless accoutrements. I mean, this is very much what he aspires to be.
I think we should state for the sake of balance here that some people like gold taps. Let's turn to some of the very real connections between Trump's advisors and Russia, which you were talking about earlier, Gabriel. This chap, Paul Manafort. Tell me a bit more about him.
Okay, well, Paul Manafort is a political strategist, well known in Washington. He's worked on many Republican campaigns. So he's got a bona fide reputation as an American political strategist. But he's also worked around the world on very lucrative contracts with some slightly less salubrious world leaders trying to buff up their electoral chances.
Like who?
Well, like Viktor Yanukovych, the former Ukrainian president who famously had to flee, and then we all, myself included, tramped over his dacha and saw his gold-studded boat and his ostrich petting zoo and etc. He worked for Yanukovych, but he also worked with other Ukrainian oligarchs who got connections to Russia. He's not the only one, though. There's this guy called Carter Page, a former investment banker from Merrill Lynch. He was hired by the Trump campaign this spring, and he talked publicly on the record about his position on Russian sanctions. When he was an investment banker in Moscow, he made lots of contacts there. He said in an interview, as soon as my role on the campaign was made public, I was flooded with messages from friends from Moscow saying, this is great, you can do something about these pesky sanctions. Of course, people seized on that as an example that Trump was surrounding himself with people who've got pro-Kremlin views.
And Applebaum, can I just ask you this question quickly? What would have happened had an advisor, let's say, who'd been appointed to John McCain's campaign or Mitt Romney's campaign, the last two Republican presidential candidates, said something like that?
It's unthinkable. It's impossible to imagine that John McCain would have hired somebody who would have been in favor of a dictatorship or somebody who had worked for foreign oligarchs.
I should say that we don't know how influential Carter Page really is. And Michael Caputo mentioned, and this may be unfair to Mr. Page, but he did say that when Carter Page was brought on board, Trump was seen as so toxic by the Republican establishment that very few people were willing to work with him.
And Applebaum, one thing you might say about Donald Trump is he doesn't actually look as if he's immensely influenced by anybody other than himself. What evidence do we have that actually somebody like Paul Manafort, who's now gone, of course, really influenced the way in which Trump's campaign developed?
Well, there are a few things. I mean, there was the incident that you mentioned at the Republican National Convention. The more circumstantial subject is the tactics that are being used by the Trump campaign. And these include a very vicious internet campaign, trolling campaign of a kind that is familiar to people who have watched this happen in other East European countries. This is a pattern. We see Russian support for far right and far left and disruptive candidates almost everywhere in the West. We see it in Poland. We see it in Ukraine, of course. We also see it in France with Putin's support for Marine Le Pen.
Okay, well, let's tease that specific point out because quite a lot of what we're talking about is speculative. But here in the question of the hacking business is something that conceivably presents concrete evidence. Gabriel Gatehouse, what actually is the evidence of what happened?
First of all, what happened? So in the run-up to the Democratic National Convention, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, had its computer servers hacked. A whole bunch of stuff was leaked via WikiLeaks. And some of it was very embarrassing, and it led to the resignation of the Democratic chairwoman. The hacker who purportedly carried this out outed himself online and said he was a Romanian. Vice News got in touch with this purported hacker and started talking to him. And according to them, when they tried to ask him some questions in Romanian, he was unable to respond in proper Romanian. Perhaps more telling is that cyber experts think the DNC was hacked by two groups, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. You could probably see where we're leading with this. Experts believe these two bears represent two different branches of Russian intelligence. One of the things that led them to believe this is that they left Cyrillic language settings in the metadata. We don't know for sure whether this was a Russian hack. We don't know for sure whether it was a Russian government hack. And if those two things are true, we don't know for sure what the motivation was and whether the motivation had anything to do with Donald Trump.
Franklin Fire, you've spoken, I would imagine, to people linked to the intelligence services. What are they saying about these hacks? Do they believe that they were carried out by Russia?
Well, first, it's important to say that the U.S. intelligence services are going to be loath to comment about a presidential election because they don't want to be seen as tipping the election in favor of one candidate or another. But the intelligence community, short of the highest levels, has done a lot of talking, and they have made it clear that they do believe that Russian intelligence services had a hand in this hack. It's not just the hack of the Democratic National Committee servers and the Clinton Foundation servers that we know about. There's also evidence that these hacking units also tapped servers in Arizona and Illinois where votes are tabulated. And so there's this larger fear that the very integrity of the election is under threat to the Russians.
Anne Applebaum, what would be the goal for Russia here?
I think the most important objective is disruption. But the real goal is to remove the United States as a contender, even as an ideological challenge for Russia. What is Putin's great? What is the greatest threat to his power? The thing that he fears the most is a kind of democratic street revolution, an anti-corruption revolution, something like what happened in Ukraine in 2014. How has he been fighting against that possibility? The main way he's been fighting about it is by staging a really extraordinary propaganda campaign inside Russia designed to discredit Europe, designed to discredit democracy, discredit NATO, discredit the United States. What he wants to be able to say to the Russian people is, you know, maybe things aren't going well here, but it's much worse over there. I know that sounds probably extreme to British listeners, but remember, this is something that he's been doing elsewhere in Europe.
But you and I recall all too well previous leaders in the Soviet era who also wanted to weaken American power relative to their own. But almost an even greater fear was of great instability. Can you imagine anybody in the Kremlin saying to Vladimir Putin, look, it's one thing to think that you might cause some kind of disruption, but actually it might cause so much disruption that it brings down the whole pack of cards.
Putin is interested in disruption. He doesn't like the status quo. And that makes him very different from a Soviet leader.
Is he more adventurous than they were?
In that sense, yes. He's less powerful than they were as well, as a percentage of the world economy and so on. What he's selling, what he's showing to the world is different. He's not trying to say Russia's model is better, be like us. But he's trying to change the balance of forces, particularly in Europe, and he would particularly like the United States out of Europe.
I think we should say that apart from those quite abstract aims, which I think indeed are there, there are some very concrete aims, and one very concrete aim, which is that Putin doesn't like the sanctions that have been put in place against Russia.
Yes. Since Crimea.
Since Crimea, as a result of his adventures in Ukraine. The Kremlin would argue, and many Russians would agree with him there, that the methods that Russia is using now are exactly the same methods as the West has been using all over Europe, for example, supporting Orange Revolutions, Maidan, Pará in Serbia. Those are the arguments he would use, and he might say, this is the same as you guys are doing, we're just doing it better.
So you support what we see as the Democrats in Ukraine, so I'll make sure that a Russian bank lends some money to Marine Le Pen, see how you like
That's the rationale.
Franklin Foer.
To this point, Putin, he's faced this unified bloc of Western opposition. And what he wants to do is he wants to conduct a negotiation with the West, where he horse trades, that he does something in Syria, which brings him a bit of relief in sanctions. He's able to get legitimacy for the annexation of Crimea in exchange for backing off in Ukraine. And of course, this is exactly what Trump is promising. Trump is the guy who wrote The Art of the Deal. He prides himself on his negotiating bravura, as opposed to the much more moralistic Atlanticist foreign policy that Hillary Clinton would clearly practice.
Anne Applebaum.
I agree that he also has concrete aims, and I would add as one of them, his verbalized dislike of Hillary Clinton. You spoke about how he blames the West for demonstrations. When there were demonstrations in Moscow in 2011, he very specifically blamed Hillary Clinton for this. I think it should be understood, of course, that this is fantasy, but he does see the world as a mirror reflection of his world, and he sees Hillary as a kind of opposite to himself.
Indeed, we know that in Russia, say, one of the things they've done where you've had human rights organisations have had any funding from abroad, they've made them declare themselves as foreign agents to emphasise this idea that actually they're the products of foreign intervention.
And let's be clear, who is the Kremlin now? Who is Putin and who are the people around? And these are people who were trained in the old KGB, and they see the world as a series of conspiracies. Any foreign effort in Russia at all, they perceive to be a kind of intelligence operation.
So Trump gets in, and they might hope for no sanctions or removal of sanctions. On the other hand, Putin has gone a long way to getting an agreement with Barack Obama over Syria. And one presumes that this is an agreement which would cross to a Clinton administration.
I think any Syria deal, if it lasts that long, which it might well not, would certainly cross over to any administration. The great thing about the United States is that it has institutions that are designed to outlive and outlast, at least in the short to medium term, whoever's in charge. Where Donald Trump is very different from other leaders is that in some ways, it looks like he thinks more like a businessman than your traditional politician. And that's, I think, where people have concerns that he might be swayable, not just through flattery, but through this idea of business interest, that his political calculus is more focused on business and therefore less predictable to those of us who've been studying how foreign policy works.
Trump represents Putin's fantasy candidate. It's not just that he started praising Putin with slavish devotion in the midst of this campaign. This is a record of sucking up to Putin that goes back nearly a decade. And everything that Donald Trump has said, from his view of NATO, his opinion about Brexit, to his view of the annexation of Crimea, all of it accords with Putin's foreign policy. Even if Hillary Clinton would be a reliable, predictable partner for the Russians, Trump is just such a golden opportunity for him.
Well, let's suppose all this is true for the moment, and let's imagine that there is indeed a President Trump come next January. What would be the implications, Anne Applebaum, for the rest of us?
We have to assume that he would withdraw or dramatically alter America's support for NATO. We'd have to, of course, assume lifting of sanctions on Russia, possibly leading to further Russian invasion of Ukraine. With the weakening of NATO, we'd have to assume greater Russian aggression in the rest of Europe and possibly elsewhere in the world. And we might have to assume knock-on effects in other theaters. We might have to assume, you know, that the Chinese would say, right, well, if the Americans aren't going to support NATO, maybe they're not going to support Japan and Taiwan either. I'm just guessing. But if you look at the removal of the American presence from the world, then you have to assume an extremely different world, which might come about very quickly.
So my final question is this, really. It comes back to a point that Gabriel Gatehouse made earlier. The president is a very powerful figure, but also there are important continuities in American foreign policy and foreign institutions. Franklin Foer, is it possible for a president so minded effectively to override those limitations and to recreate American policy as drastically as Putin would like Trump to?
We're at a moment in American history where the executive branch of power is extremely strong. Presidents have the ability to essentially conduct war without congressional approval. They have an incredible ability to put their stamp on the foreign policy of the nation. And the thing about Donald Trump is that we've also seen evidence that on very core positions, he swings from one extreme to the next. Despite the fact that Putin has flattered him and that he has said all these flattering things about Putin, he's so unpredictable, it's not inconceivable that he could swing to some sort of other extreme where he put the country on a path to war with Russia at some point.
Thanks very much. That's almost all we have time for. I think we can sum it up like this. Russia may well be behind hacks designed to disrupt the Democratic campaign for the presidency. Several of Trump's advisers have ties to Russia. Trump tried to do business in Russia and made connections, but not much else. And for Putin, Trump might be the ideal candidate now, but in January, who knows? Thanks to my guests in the briefing room, Franklin Foer, Anne Applebaum and Gabriel Gatehouse. Until next week, goodbye.
David Aronovich presented the briefing room. The producer was me, Mike Wendling, and the editor was Innes Bowen. If you like this podcast, you may like a sister podcast also produced by the BBC. It's called The Inquiry, and they have done a number of excellent programs about the phenomenon of Donald Trump and politics in the United States and elsewhere. The most recent one they've done is called Would Donald Trump Be a Dangerous President? That's The Inquiry. It's available now to download from the BBC World Service. And if you like the Briefing Room podcast, please take a moment and leave us a review. Thanks for listening.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.